It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, a look at a lawsuit filed today challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage.
First, it's part two of a series produced by WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on releasing and retaining violent sex offenders in Wisconsin's criminal justice system. Today, it's a look at the Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center in Mauston, which looks and feels like a prison, but the sex offenders held there are considered patients, not inmates. Gilman Halstead reports on the treatment these patients receive as they try to shed the label the state has given them of being sexually violent people.
Visitors to Sand Ridge go through a metal detector and then a gate in a razor wire fence and several secure doors before entering the antiseptically clean and brightly lit hallways. The cream-colored cinder block walls are decorated with a blue trim. Hallways are brighter than those at a typical maximum security prison in the state. Some patients working in the cafeteria or doing janitorial jobs wear green smock-like shirts, but those who have made the most progress in their treatment can wear their own clothes. Making progress in therapy is easier for some than it is for others. Clint is 49 years old and has been at Sand Ridge since 2008 after serving a 17-year sentence in prison for sexual assault and homicide. He says the treatment is helping him prepare for supervised release.
As far as the law goes, we're here for treatment. As far as supervised release goes, that's what I'm planning to do. I have to have significant progress in treatment. So it's helpful that way.
He says much of the 6 hours of treatment he takes part in each week are a rehash of programs he completed while in prison. Some involve role plays where he has to confront his risk factors for reoffending. The most useful one, he says, is simply called mindfulness.
I find that really helpful. Learning how to slow my thinking down, learning how to process things that I'm going through in order to make better decisions.
Clint is among the 82% of patients who've been diagnosed with a personality disorder specifically related to sex offending. Another 10% have a serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, and 9% are labeled mentally retarded. Sand Ridge Research Director David Thornton says there's also a minority of patients who simply refuse treatment.
You'll have some individuals who've essentially made the life choice that committing sex offenses and thinking about committing future sex offenses is a life that they enjoy better than what would be involved in the hard work of changing themselves and living in a law-abiding way in the community.
Even the patients who don't cooperate with the therapy requirements have the same right to petition a court for release as those who do undergo treatment, but their likelihood of success is slim. One patient interviewed for this story did win a court battle for release without going through treatment. Thomas served 17 years in prison for sexual assault before being committed to Sand Ridge in 2004. During an interview before his release, he voiced a concern many patients at Sand Ridge share. He says if a mental illness diagnosis is the trigger for commitment to the center, then men like him should have the option of getting outpatient treatment instead of being locked up.
Why not go to the mental health facility in your community? Like Green Bay, they have Brown County Mental Health Facility. Why not then go in there? They have sex treatment there also. So to just put you here and not put you in your community's one, because your community's paying the bill, and not let you go there, why not?
Other Sand Ridge patients challenged the right of the state to keep them locked up at all for crimes they might commit after they've already served time for a crime they did commit. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow in part three of that series, we'll look at the case of a Sand Ridge patient who doesn't think he belongs there at all because he says he's not mentally ill. Meanwhile, you can see the full report at wisconsinwatch.org and in newspapers around the state. Nearly 100 million people tuned into Fox last night to watch Super Bowl 48. Some were Denver fans, some were Seattle fans, some just wanted to see all the big commercials, which become almost bigger than the game itself for some people.
The ads this year were either home runs or spectacular flops, depending on who you ask. But from a marketing perspective, which ones really worked?
Here to break down this year's batch of ads is Derek Rucker. He's professor of marketing in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where he co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a broad question here. What's the goal of these hyper-expensive Super Bowl ads? What are they hoping to get out of that?
Yeah, one of the goals is it's an immense reach strategy in terms of just hitting a lot of consumers all at once, right? So you're going to have like 100 million people looking at this ad. So if I have a new product launching, a new message, a new positioning, this is a way for me to get a massive footprint in front of a lot of people.
Used to be it was a tightly guarded secret. They surprised you with their big ad. Now it seems like, I saw a bunch of ads for the Bud Light ad in the last like 3 weeks of football games. People are leaking, showing snippets here and there. Why that change?
Well, there's a few reasons. So one is that as costs have gone up, brands are forced to figure out how do they maximize the spend, right? So now it's not just about the 30 seconds. Having 100 million people see it, that's still important, but I'm trying to maximize consumer engagement both before the spot airs and after it. So we're trying to get the most for our money in our buys. That means taking advantage of it at more than a single point in time.
Before we start digging into the particular ads, just some general impressions. Is it just me, or is there a lot less sex out front and center in these ads than there used to be?
Yeah, I would say that this was a really subdued year for the Super Bowl advertising. So one of the kind of golden metric for me is there an ad from the bunch that's going to be in my Hall of Fame of Super Bowl ads? And it happens in recent years. So I think of Volkswagen's Darth Vader ad, right? The little kid walking. And people know this ad. They love it for a few years back. I don't think there's a single ad here that's going to make it to that degree where 2 years from now we're talking about it.
Well, it seems like the theme of the successful ads here were things that make us go, aw. So family, inspiration.
Emotional stirring, yeah.
Let's check out a Cheerios ad along that line. I think it might be a good example. Here it is.
Pretty soon, you're going to have a baby brother.
And a puppy.
Deal.
Okay, just and these we've seen this family, I think, in Cheerios ads in the past, just like a slice of life family scene.
Yeah, I think it's one of those. It's just wholesome. It's with the brand's equity. It's a spot where I think if you'd had those over the top ads that may not have done as well, but given that the overall competition wasn't that fierce in the ad world, it worked this year.
Let's check out. You mentioned a past one from Volkswagen. Let's listen to a piece of what they did this time around.
Absolutely.
Hey, Darcy, look. 100,000 miles.
So?
It's a big deal. What if I told you that every time a Volkswagen hits 100,000 miles, a German engineer gets his wings?
And we see the German engineer getting his wings. That was
many
another
of them.
One. Many of them, right. That was another one that you rated highly. Why?
So that one is, I think, what it does what a good ad should do, which is it's entertaining and engaging, right? So the whole idea of getting their wings, that's cute. People can relate to that. But at the same time, that story tells you something about the brand, which is our reliability, right? Or a brand, it's happening. So it's not just that one engineer gets the wings. It's that many are getting them, and it's happening a lot. So it's both a clever message to draw the audience in, and it actually says something about the brand, and that's what we care about.
Well, and that's the thing that I would imagine advertisers worry about, but seems to happen every year. You've come up with a brilliant, clever, funny, heartwarming, whatever ad, and then people talk about the ad but don't remember the brand.
It's exactly the problem. It's this constant tension between strategy and creative, and the brands that work best are ones that have figured it out. They figured out, we have a game plan. We know what the consumer needs to hear. Figure out how to say it in a really clever way. And the great thing about Super Bowl advertising is every year there are brands that fail.
We'll talk about some more of those Super Bowl ads. We're talking about the crop of Super Bowl ads, less sex, less zaniness, more heartwarming for the most part. We've got Derek Rucker with the Super Bowl Advertising Review with us now. We'd like to hear from you, too. What was your favorite or your least favorite spot from last night, or maybe your favorite Super Bowl ad of all time. Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. We're talking about the best and worst of the year's Super Bowl commercials, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What ads worked for you? Are you running out to the store now to buy some Bud Light or Coca-Cola or a Maserati? Pick me one up while you're out. You can call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We've got Denise in Milwaukee on the line. Denise, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to just mention the Coca-Cola ad because it's getting so much flack on Facebook. Really nasty comments about it. And we really felt it was a wonderful, diverse, true representation of population in the United States. And, you know, there was something like, for example, one of the languages I believe was Hawaiian. And there was a lot of statements around how that, you know, none of that's English, that's American. You know? But, you know, Hawaii is a state. And if they're speaking Hawaiian there, then guess what? That's American, too.
Denise, thanks for bringing that one up. We've got a clip from the song. It's a version of America the Beautiful in a Coke ad.
Beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de granos tambar.
Your peach in the tzakuti.
So what do you think of that one? What is this an effective brand strategy?
You know, for a panel, that ad did fine. I think it fits with what Coca-Cola typically does, which is to kind of focus on warm and happy moments. So I think as a brand, you know, it fell in the middle of the pack, I think, between a B and a C. To the comment that was raised by Denise, I believe, I think that's a great example of how social media is transforming how people communicate. So there were some people who talked negatively about it, but if you look at it, there were then people who were outraged at the outragers.
Right. So, Derek, that's Coke maybe sent a message, maybe knowing that they were trolling a bit, they're going to get a bit of a response that reinforces what they were doing in the first place.
It's possible. I don't know if that was intentional. We usually try not to do that in advertising and get negative elements. But I think what it says is that, look, any consumer can have their opinion of an ad, and that's kind of what makes it interesting. When people go negative, social media allows that to spread faster. But now we actually have people who are willing to jump in and police there. And so you see people coming to the brand's defense, like for the example it was given by the caller. You know, it's like, well, they're singing in Hawaiian.
Well, and Coke, you know, they did I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing years ago. This
Absolutely.
One is another happy, touchy-feely thing. Does it tell us anything about Coke, though?
Well, so what you have to
Fizzy.
It's a great question. And what you have to realize is as brands mature or get more advanced, the consumer knows enough about the core brand that I don't need to convince you, drink Coke, here's how it tastes or here's what it's like. The consumer knows that experience. So it really is about creating a more fundamental relationship with the consumer between the brand. So that's why you see these emotional appeals being represented, because it's just about you enjoying the brand, thinking positively about the brand.
Talking to Derek Rucker of Northwestern University about Super Bowl ads. Join in with your favorites or least favorites. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's check out another ad. This one, I think this is another one of your highly rated ones. This is Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Technology has taken us places we've only dreamed.
Now I can do whatever I want.
It gives hope to the hopeless.
Can you hear me talking?
Okay, so this was a tearjerker one. The visuals you're not seeing along with it are a kid who's a double amputee walking on high-tech legs, and somebody deployed overseas witnessing the birth of his daughter. This seemed like Microsoft viewed as a stodgy company, technology viewed as a cold, heartless sort of thing, and then trying to make it as warm and human as possible in this ad, Derek.
Yeah, I think, and this one did really well with our panel. It was actually the top rated. And I think the reason it resonated with them is that you see the brand strategy and the emotionally compelling message, which is you think about Apple, who has positioned themselves well as cool and hip. And now Microsoft is kind of coming back and saying, well, we're important too. And we're important in the sense of technology doing meaningful things in people's lives.
All right. We've got callers coming in. We've got a tweet first from Allison, who writes, "Everyone is still talking about that brilliant e-surance commercial. It was promoted on Twitter beforehand. I've been getting updates all day on how many of my friends have followed the @esurancemillion handle. Smart way to spend a lot of money, but engage your fans." Is that the one at the end of the game with John Krasinski, I think, from The Office with a big pile of money, or am I mixing that up?
I think that's right. I think that's the, you know, rather than spend during the Super Bowl, we're going to spend, you know, $1.5 million to a lucky fan of some sort. I believe that's what it was, a $1.5 million giveaway.
Right. Right. And, you know, I was wondering, do advertisers have a heart attack when the game is a blowout as it was last night? And maybe people aren't going to stick around to watch their fourth quarter or post game ad?
You do. So the funny thing is, when we were doing the ad review, we had both Denver and Seattle fans in our panel. And so the Seattle fans were obviously ecstatic. And I remember standing up when I think it was like 29 or nothing. I'm like, "So I know you Seattle fans are really happy. Advertisers, not happy right now."
Right. Right.
So you worry about that. You know, the good news is that for the best ads or the best brands, and this is part of the reason that justifies the price tag, is that people are talking about them the next day, and they're easy to watch again on YouTube now, right? So this is where media really helps, social media and online really helps, is that if you missed it, but something was so good that you're hearing about it, you can still see it. Of course, if it's not so good, you're not going to see it at all.
Sorry to those Denver fans in your group. We'll go back to the phones now with Amanda in Watertown. Hi there, Amanda.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I find it very interesting that there's so much controversy surrounding the Coke ad when the Cheerios ad was actually a response to the multiracial controversy that happened in the first place with their first ad.
Interesting point, Amanda. Derek, that's right. There was controversy about that it's a multiracial family in that Cheerios ad.
Yeah, actually, that was something, you know, that was really neat and bold to see Cheerios go, is to say, "We're sticking with our message. You know, and we realized that times have changed, and so we're not going to go backwards and say, you know, concede that point." So that was kind of a really bold move by the brand that was beautiful to see. And I think what it shows you is that, you know, the whole idea of whether an ad is racy or it says something wrong, it's subjective. And it's which ones do you have enough of a critical mass behind to push.
Speaking of times have changed, let's check out this ad from Radio Shack.
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
The 80s called. They want their store back.
And then there's a parade of 80s icons. Alf, Hulk Hogan, Mary Lou Retton, and more.
Dee Snider.
Right, yeah. So this is one really acknowledging what is seen as a downside of a store and trying to reframe it.
Yeah, and so this was my personal favorite ad. And I think that's partly the fact that I'm a child of the 80s.
Me
so
too, yeah.
If you grew up in the 80s, it's like, oh, wow, this had a moment for you, right? And I just remember seeing, I watched it a few times and realizing all the things I missed the first time. So it's like, oh, there's Kid in Play. There's that owl from Clash of the Titans. And so all these things are flooding back. And so I think what's interesting is if you look at our panel, who are about 26, like, yeah, they missed the 80s. So that shows you for a population, and our panel still liked it, by the way. They still gave it a B because they said, hey, it shows a very clear positioning change, right? Radio Shack is trying to say we used to be this way, now we're this way. But I think it had some added zest for individuals who actually could resonate with those characters.
Back to the phones now. We've got Gina in Milwaukee. Hi there, Gina.
Hello.
What's your ad?
My favorite ad, and it's going to stay with me, is the Chobani ad with John Stamos. I mean, it's talking about generations that it appealed to. I remember John Stamos when he was Blackie, and I had his picture posted all over my wall. And then he went into the 80s with Full House, and they kind of brought his sex appeal, which he's never aged in all these years, and to tie in the Full House, it was just funny. It was a phenomenal ad, I think. And I won't forget the brand of Chobani.
All right. John Stamos gets an A for sexiness from Gina, Derek.
Yeah, it's pretty funny in her comment. Like, that was actually the Dannon's brand, not the Chobani ad.
Uh-oh. That's right. Chobani had the bear?
They had the bear ad. So that's okay, because it shows that she really did like Stamos. And that shows you a classic problem in advertising that, you know, that might be an isolated incident and not representative of all consumers. But sometimes when you use celebrity, if the celebrity overwhelms the execution, you get exactly that phenomena, which is, oh, I love the Stamos ad. Oh, it was for yogurt. And if you think of Greek yogurt, Chobani's the one that often comes to mind.
Just about out of time, Derek, I wanted to end by asking you, are Super Bowl ads worth the money?
They are for the right brand. And so what's that mean? That means a brand who's going to have a creative strategy that is going to get talked about and deliver a powerful brand message. If you have those things in place, this is just a massive audience to reach. If you don't, though, if you're just bringing like your B or your C game, it's not the place to do it.
Well, Derek, you brought your A game today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Derek Rucker. He co-leads the Super Bowl Advertising Review at Northwestern University. We've been talking about the best and worst ads at last night's Super Bowl. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who went on a mission to Mars. Well, not exactly. It was a mock mission to Mars. We'll learn about what was done to replicate conditions on the Red Planet.
But first, breaking news today. The American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin filed a federal lawsuit challenging the legality of the ban on same-sex marriages here in the Badger State.
The ACLU filed the suit on behalf of four same-sex couples in Wisconsin. Three of the couples want the state to allow them to get married. The fourth got married in Minnesota and wants Wisconsin to recognize their union.
Here to give us the details of this case is Chris Amity, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here and talk to your NPR audience.
Well, tell us why you're filing this lawsuit.
We're filing this lawsuit because there are couples in Wisconsin, loving and committed couples, who are denied the dignity and respect that usually goes along with being married because of their sexual orientation or their gender. We think that's wrong, it's unfair, and it's unconstitutional. It not only denies them the dignity and respect that all loving, committed couples should have from their government, but it also denies them hundreds of benefits that they would get if they were a heterosexual couple.
And on what legal grounds are you challenging the ban on same-sex marriage?
Well, we think that it violates some portions of the U.S. Constitution. It's contrary to due process. It also violates equal protection under the law. And, you know, but for their sexual orientation and the constitutional amendment that went into place here in Wisconsin and 2006, which prohibits all marriages, recognition of all marriages except between one man and one woman, they could live their lives and raise their families and go about their business with the same sort of support and dignity that other couples have. And I think that it's time to act now here in Wisconsin. You know, since the ACLU won its major victory at the U.S. Supreme Court this past June with the Windsor case that struck down a provision of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, we've seen an outpouring of support around the country for couples who really deserve to have their marriages recognized. There are now 17 states where there's the freedom to marry. And we've seen changes in polling numbers. A recent poll came out here in Wisconsin, and now a majority of Wisconsinites support marriage equality.
But let's talk about states' rights for a bit here. The amendment to ban same-sex unions, marriages, and civil unions has been ratified by the majority of Wisconsin voters. From a state's rights perspective, is that enough to maintain the law here in Wisconsin?
No. Just I can answer that because, you know, when it comes to constitutional rights, and the ACLU deals with this all the time, sometimes it's people who aren't in the majority that have their rights denied. And under our constitutional system, where there's equal protection under the law, if you can't come up with compelling reasons to limit somebody's freedom, in this case freedom to marry, you can't do it just because it's a tradition or because a majority of people voted that way or felt that way in an opinion poll. Of course, now the opinion polls have switched to around. But I think that anybody who recognizes the fundamental nature of civil liberty, civil rights, recognizes that you've got to defend rights of people who maybe aren't the same as you. And this is a classic example. So, yes, you know, there was the referendum, and the Constitution was amended in 2006, but that doesn't mean that that prohibits a review of the law, of the amendment under the federal Constitution. And we've seen that in many states around the country. If you look at the Windsor decision that ACLU won back in June that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, you know, that decision really called into question the validity of all these state constitutional amendments. It didn't overturn them, but really, since that time, there have been many challenges to these state constitutional amendments, and I think a lot of people are saying today, when they heard the news that ACLU was sued, they're saying it's about time. We should have done this, because the outpouring of support for couples has just been a tidal wave, and at ACLU, we want to make sure that everybody has constitutional rights that are respected here in Wisconsin, in the states around us, Iowa, then Minnesota, and then recently Illinois. They now all have freedom to marry. Wisconsin really was in danger of becoming, you know, an island of prohibition against marriage equality, if you will. So it's certainly time to do it, and it's not something that's up to majoritarian rule. People have constitutional rights because they're important, whether you're in the majority or in a minority.
Why do you say that this is one of the most restrictive bans on same-sex marriage in the nation as compared to other states?
Right. Well, it's restrictive because it's one of 17 such bans around the country that bans not only marriage, but also anything substantially similar to marriage, such as civil unions, you know, a la sort of Vermont-style civil union. So they have that, but also in Wisconsin, there's another wrinkle that is somewhat unusual, and that's the fact that if a Wisconsin couple were to leave the state where it's to a state where it's legal to have a same-sex marriage, where there's already marriage equality, like Minnesota, like Iowa, we're going back many years, you know, Massachusetts. If they came back here, there's the possibility, it's a slight possibility, but there's a serious risk that they could be charged criminally under Wisconsin's marriage evasion statutes, very obscure sort of technical part of the statutes. But it's illegal to go to another state where for a marriage that would be void in Wisconsin. Now, we don't object to the marriage evasion statute when it comes to the uses that it's had in the past, you know, youngsters underage running off somewhere. But here, you know, while there may be some reason to restrict those or criminalize those sorts of marriages, there's certainly no reason to do that with same-sex couples. You know, there's absolutely no reason to do that.
Can you tell?
Other than that, you know, people don't like the idea, or it's not tradition, or whatever. But you know, if you're going to criminalize something, you just can't do it because you don't like the way somebody's acting.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the four couples that are represented by your lawsuit.
Sure. There are four couples that we think are really kind of typical of many, many committed, loving couples here in Wisconsin. Carol and Virginia are from Eau Claire. Siobhan and Marie are from Milwaukee, as are Judy and Katie. Roy and Garth are from Milwaukee. And all of them are in, you know, sort of traditional, they are traditional relationships because people care for one another. You know, 3 years ago, Garth had much of his right lung removed after being diagnosed with lung cancer. And he was put into a medically induced coma. Because Garth and Roy were not married, when Garth's father tried to override Roy's power of attorney to take care of Garth, there was all kinds of family problems. And sure, we want to respect parents and all that, just like you would respect your in-laws. But if they had their relationship, their marriage recognized, that they were able to marry in Wisconsin, all those problems would have been sorted out. It would have been known ahead of time and could have been dealt with. Now, Virginia and Carol, who are up in Eau Claire, you know, they went to Minnesota to marry. And they've been together for a long time and have had lots of the same kinds of issues that other couples have about, well, what about insurance and what about health care and visitation and all sorts of things. And because their out-of-state marriage wasn't recognized, it's very difficult, and they were really harmed in a couple different ways. One, you know, why do you have to go through all this? It should be simple. You know, your loved one is ill. Why can't you just go to the hospital and be treated with the respect and dignity that you reserve when you deserve?
Well,
also,
Chris,
you know, it's having cost these and other folks, you know, in terms of hundreds and hundreds of different sorts of benefits that they would be eligible for in Wisconsin if Wisconsin would recognize their marriages.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Chris Amity, Executive Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. He's talking to us about the suit challenging Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriages. When people talk about the future of space exploration, the topic of a manned mission to Mars always seems to generate a lot of excitement and a lot of discussion about what life would be like on the red planet.
Earlier this month, a group of scientists headed into the middle of the Utah desert. For 2 weeks, they conducted a mock Mars mission to try and simulate what a real-life mission might be like.
Our next guest got to go along on the mission, and she chronicled her journey for space.com. Elizabeth Howell is a space journalist and was a member of Crew 133 at the Mars Desert Research Station. She's here to tell us about her experience. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Cynthia, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, tell us about the Mars Desert Research Station. How did you find yourself on the crew of a two-week simulated mission to Mars?
It was really an 11-year journey because it's been in existence since about 2002, and I've always wanted to go. However, you need to have some qualifications to get there, and in my case, I needed to sort of build up my experience in the space journalism field, which I've luckily got to do in the last couple of years. In addition to that, I'm also a student at the University of North Dakota, which is it's a space studies program. I'm a distance student, a Canadian who does the work there. And when I was doing my studies there, I still am, I got an email from one of the other students who happened to have been on two previous missions to the Mars Desert Research Station, and she wanted to know if anybody at the university was interested in participating. And that's essentially how I got on the crew. I presented my credentials as a journalist. They needed a crew journalist, and I got right on there. So it was pretty exciting.
When they do these mock missions, what's the goal? What are we trying to learn?
We're trying to figure out what kind of procedures and what kinds of experiments would work here and also on the red planet. Now, there are a few limitations, of course, where it's only 2 weeks as opposed to a couple of years, which is what a Mars mission would take. We can't simulate things like the lack of atmosphere or the lack of gravity or the lesser gravity that Mars has. But all that being said, there are a lot of things that are quite similar. We were sitting out in the middle of the desert, as you had mentioned earlier, and that meant that we had to basically rely on ourselves. The nearest town was about a 7 or 8 mile drive away over very hilly roads, and we, of course, were not encouraged to go there. We were in full simulation, and so we had to come up with a lot of resources by ourselves. Just sort of if something broke, we had to figure out how to fix it on station, that kind of thing. Another thing that we had to do as well was to communicate with the outside world only by email, because when you're doing a mission to Mars, it's about a 20-minute time delay between Earth and Mars, and so it takes some time to take communications there back and forth. And so email was the best way that we could simulate it, even though we didn't have a time delay. And then the third thing we did was we went outside in spacesuits, these mock spacesuits. That we would have a jumpsuit, we put on a helmet, we'd have a backpack, and we'd go outside every single time to do our tasks out there, because essentially if you walked outside on Mars without a spacesuit, you die. So we wanted to make sure that we had that aspect simulated as much as we could.
Why was it important to simulate it to that extent? I mean, you have perfectly good oxygen to breathe in Utah.
It's very true. But at the same time, when you're trying to do something such as set up a radio telescope, it's such a big difference if you're doing it in this mock spacesuit as opposed to doing it with just your normal clothing, as we discovered, because we actually were putting up a radio telescope, and those things are bulky and they're heavy, and you're trying to swing hammers and drive these stakes into the ground. Your center of gravity feels all weird because you got this heavy backpack on your back, and you're feeling all awkward. You can't hear things properly because you have the helmet over your ears. So it changes the experience completely, and what we thought was going to take about an hour to set up ended up taking two, just because we had all these different things to contend with.
We have a fashion picture of Elizabeth, by the way, in her suit on our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. Elizabeth, how do you pack for a trip like this?
It's really hard because you're spending three weeks on the road without laundry. In the middle of nowhere, where you couldn't go out to get shampoo if you forgot it. So I was a terror that I would forget something important. And in fact, I did. I forgot lip balm. So I had to ask my crewmates to give me some extra, because it's dry out there. So what you're doing is you're trying to think, all right, what kind of things would I need if there was a power failure, where I would need extra clothing, I would need a sleeping bag, I would need to get various warm things. What would I need if my clothes got dirty? Well, I need extra clothes. And so you can imagine you're starting to pile things on. You're saying, all right, I need warm winter clothes. I need cooler clothes. I need clothes for bedtime. I need clothes for working outside. And also they have to be clothes that you don't care about very much, because anything that you put on got dirty within literally 10 minutes. I remember one time putting on some pants and looking down, already I had smudged mud all over them somehow, because mud would just blow in. We would keep the windows and the doors all closed as much as we could, but as soon as we went out for a Mars walk, so to speak, and came back in, we'd be tracking mud everywhere. We'd sweep it up, and then the next time somebody went out, the same problem would happen. So it was just a big challenge. I had four bags that I was carrying back and forth from Ottawa, Canada, all the way over to Las Vegas and zigzagging back to Utah because of the flight paths and all that. And I just had to make sure I didn't forget anything as I was going along there. But it seemed to work out pretty well.
Tell us about the crew you were with.
They were phenomenal. They ranged in age from about 30 to 60 years old. They came from three countries. I was a Canadian. We had four from the United States and one from France, and all from different backgrounds. We had people that were doctor. We had a doctor on the crew. We had an engineer on the crew. We had a couple of scientists. We had people who had gone back to grad school after doing another career, you know, essentially an executive career. So just having this diversity of backgrounds and opinions and experience really came in handy when it came to solving a problem, because it usually came to a situation where you'd say, well, we need to go back on some experience, whether it be managerial or technical, and somebody who tended to have it. And that just made things amazing. So when it came to our discussions, we were very clear from the beginning. We were six strangers walking into this not knowing each other. And we said, we have to communicate. We have to be as clear as possible about what we need, because if a dispute arises and we're all just walking around with these resentments bottled up inside, we're sitting in a 1,200-foot habitat, square-foot habitat, and we're just not going to have the capability to function as a crew if we're going to be all resentful and not talking to each other about situations. So we just came in with this idea that we're going to be a family, we're going to rely on each other. If we have problems, we're going to talk it out, and I have to say it worked out so well. In fact, I'm so close to everybody right now that I'm trying to figure out how to alter my summer vacation plans so I can see as many of them as possible. The guy from France, probably not so much, but the foreign states, definitely a possibility.
So what kind of things did you do on Mars? What were your operating missions there?
Our big mission, as I said earlier, was to put up the radio telescope, but we had a number of experiments going on. The doctor from France was actually looking at whether an untrained astronaut, could administer anesthesia properly to somebody who gets hurt on Mars. And that's important because, you know, what if the doctor gets hurt? Who's going to take care of him or her? You'll have to be the other patients. And so he had a training protocol in place. He had a PowerPoint presentation and some videos and a mannequin, actually almost like an animatronic mannequin that would respond to certain things. And then he was having us inject simulated liquid into the mannequin and then monitoring the responses, which is really cool. We also had somebody else who was looking at helmet temperatures, as well as how much you were exerting yourself when you're going outside, to see if there's any kind of correlation between how hot it felt inside of there and how much you were running around out there. We had a survey that was looking at radio communications, what the dead zones were around the habitat, because for safety reasons, it's good to know where you're going to be out of radio communication. And then we had a couple of geological experiments looking at layers, and also looking at hydrothermal vents in the area. So just being embedded on this crew and watching the science in action was quite an educational experience for science journalists, because you get to see how careful they are, how incremental they are, how much they rely on other studies to get their work done. And in fact, there already are some collaborations. They're a little early stage, so I won't say what's going on right now, but there, I already have seen at least one new collaboration coming out of this research, which is really exciting for them.
Elizabeth, very short on time here. Having done this, would you want to go to real Mars sometime?
Yes, but only if there's a return ticket.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, as always. I had fun.
It's Elizabeth Howell. She just returned from a 2-week mock mission to Mars. She chronicled her experience on space.com and joined us to talk about what life could be like on the red planet.